Colin, I say. I never fail at my booty calls, Gabe says, which is probably close to the truth. Well then, why isn't she here? I ask. Because I didn't invite her. I was just starting to worry about where you were. I called you first. Check your phone. It died. I took a lot of videos. I caught Leslie in some hot girl-on-girl action. I say, thinking of the impressive grinding she and Sydney did to pour some sugar on me. Granted, it was all initiated by Sid, but still. Yeah, well, I hear you were caught in some girl-on-boy action, Gabe says. Making out on the dance floor, huh?
Holy fuck, she's a snitch, I say, taking another bite of beef.
Oh, so you wanted to keep it a secret from me?
No, it's not a secret, I say with my mouth still full. But she's exaggerating.
Right, he says, folding his arms across his chest. You know what, Josie? Johnny's Hideaway is bad. But making out at Johnny's Hideaway is on a whole other level.
I did not make out at Johnny's, I say, scraping up the last bite. His arms still crossed, he cocks his head to the side.
So you didn't kiss Pete tonight?
Yeah, I kissed him, I say, rolling my eyes. But that's a far cry from making out. Gabe gives me a disapproving stare. What? Don't give me that look, I say, then add. You know, if I didn't know any better, I'd think you were jealous. It is the sort of thing I would never say sober, which begs the question, is it really what I deep down think?
Jealous of what? Gabe retorts. I mean, if you want to choose his mediocre sperm, go right ahead, but I'm 99% sure you'll be sorry.
Mediocre sperm? I laugh. Wow, you are jealous. That's really cute.
I'm not jealous, he says. I just think it's a really bad idea to be making out with your sperm donor. If you want to date him, but then put this project on hold.
I don't want to date him. I just want a baby and some sperm.
Okay, well then frankly speaking, I think you could do better than Pete.
That's mean, I say. He's a really nice guy.
I know, but in the world of sperm, he's your top pick? Come on, Josie.
Well, who's better? I say, grateful that I switched to water when I did, that I can at least hold my own in the debate. The vegan runner? Gabe, come on, read that essay again. He sounds like a freak. Besides, I just don't like the idea of using a stranger. I'd rather go with a known quantity. He stares at me nodding, then uncrosses his arms and presses both palms onto the counter.
Okay, well how about a really known quantity?
I deposit the beef container into the trash and start in on the rice. He snatches it away from me and throws it in the trash too. Hey, I say.
You told me to never let you eat white food late at night. I'm trying to be your friend here. So, back to the known quantity. What about using a close friend instead of some guy you just met on Match?
I narrow my eyes, confused. How close of a friend? I ask. Surely he can't be suggesting what he seems to be suggesting.
Like, I don't know, a best friend?
He says, averting his eyes, looking distinctly nervous. You're kidding, right? I say with a laugh. He meets my gaze and shakes his head, stone serious. My heart flutters even more than it did on the dance floor when Pete and I kissed. I thought you didn't like messy, I say.
I don't, he says. I still think you should go with a complete stranger. But if you won't do that, you should go with someone you can trust. Someone who would always have your back and your kid's back.
You mean you? I confirm.
Yes, I mean me.
And what would that make you? I ask, my mind racing.
What do you mean? He asks.
Would you be just the donor? Or like, the father? He swallows, then says,
well, both, I guess.
So more than a donor?
Yes, Gabe says. More than a donor. More than you'd get with Pete. I'd be the dad, too.
And what about us?
I ask, fleetingly wondering if he isn't about to reveal some sort of crush on me, like Andrew McCarthy in St. Elmo's Fire.
What about us?
He asks. Well, you're not suggesting... My voice trails off as I motion between us, but his face remains blank. I finish my thought. You're not suggesting that we have sex, I say, to get pregnant?
Oh, God, no, Gabe says, making a face. Nothing like that. We'd still use this doctor lady, and we'd be totally status quo on the friendship front.
Okay, I say, nodding. But wouldn't that be weird? Gabe shrugs.
Maybe, but I don't know. I think it would be more like having Revis together.
But Revis is a dog, I say.
I know that.
And besides, Revis is mine.
Come on, that's a technicality and you know it. Who walks him more? Who takes him out at night? Who paid that last monster vet bill when he ate that sock?
It was your sock, I say, that you left out.
Come on, Josie. Whose bed does he sleep in if given the choice?
It's 50-50, I insist.
Bullshit. That dog loves me more and you know it.
I start to protest, but Gabe is on a roll.
Bottom line, I love Revis as my own. I'd do anything for him, and I'd take him if anything ever happened to you.
What if we got into a fight? I say.
We do get into fights.
I shake my head. No, not like stupid arguments over leaving dirty dishes in the sink, I say. A real fight.
Don't be dumb, he says. You know that wouldn't happen.
It could.
Okay, you're right, it could. And if it did, we'd be like other divorced couples who share custody. Only, we were never married in the first place. We'd just be skipping that part.
I nod, though I'm having trouble believing what I'm hearing. What does Leslie say about this?
I haven't discussed this with Leslie.
You think she'd be okay with it?
I do, actually.
He says so quickly that it's clear he's given it thought.
I mean, here's the way I look at it. What if I already had a kid? Would she not date me?
I have no clue, I say. I barely know her. Maybe she wouldn't.
Well, if not, that would make her shallow. And I don't do shallow. So, better to find out now.
I don't necessarily agree with that, I say. I'm not sure I'd want to be with a guy who is having a baby with another girl.
Well, then you're shallow, he says with a smile. And anyway, I really like Leslie, but she's not the deal breaker here.
Are you sure? I say. I thought you might be falling in love.
I might be, he says, but that's irrelevant. If we did this, it would be our decision. You and me, together.
I stare at him for a dizzying few seconds, trying to process everything. So are you telling me that you actually want a baby?
No, he says. I never said that. But I don't not want a baby. And I want you to have a baby if that's what you want.
That's not very convincing, I say.
I'm not trying to convince you, he says. I'm just making an offer. Take it or leave it.
I give him a hug. Welling up a little, whispering that this might be the nicest thing anyone's ever offered to do for me.
Yeah, yeah, he says, pulling away with a big yawn.
I notice that his eyes stay open, a telltale sign that it's a fake yawn, and that he's merely looking for a transition, uncomfortable with my display of emotion. Sure enough, he announces that he's going back to bed, then turns and abruptly walks out of the kitchen. Good night, Gabe. I call after him. I fucking love you.
Love you too, potty mouth,
he mumbles on his way up the stairs.
Chapter 22. Meredith. The Friday after Josie's birthday, on the afternoon I'm supposed to fly to New York, Harper has a meltdown that has absolutely nothing to do with me leaving, or her earlier realization that I will be missing trick-or-treating on Monday. A source of considerable maternal guilt. Instead, in a case of life imitating art, she has seemingly lost her beloved stuffed animal, just like the little girl in Nuffle Bunny. Harper's favorite Mo Willems book. Where did you last see it? Nolan asks her, a question that has always mystified me and seems especially ridiculous when posed to a hysterical four-year-old.
I want Rabby!
She sobs in response. I know, sweetie, I say, looking under the sofa, though I know he's too big to fit under it. We'll find him, I promise. Nolan clears his throat and says, we probably shouldn't make any promises if you get my drift. I look up at him, still on my knees, and my heart drops, considering that they just returned home from a father-daughter outing to Legoland. Nolan, I say slowly, are you trying to tell me something here? Maybe, he says, his voice rising in a question, looking panic-stricken. Please, please, for the love of God, tell me that Harper did not take Rabby to Legoland, I say, standing and looking directly into his eyes. Nolan stares back at me, but he doesn't reply, as a wave of terror passes through me. I remind myself that I still have Harper, that there hasn't been a kidnapping, that we're talking about a stuffed animal, an inanimate object. I'm positive we had him in the car, Nolan says, looking anything but positive. How positive? I say. 100% positive, he says. I remember seeing Rabby in the rearview mirror. For 1 second, I'm relieved. Then I say, wait, on the way there or on the way home? Nolan scratches his head and shrugs. That I'm not sure about, he says. Nolan, I groan, pressing my hands to my forehead. How many times have I told you not to let her take Rabby out of the house? You know it would be a disaster if he gets lost for good. I didn't know she had him when we left, he says. I take a deep breath, my mind racing. Did you call Legoland? I say, as Harper's sobs begin to ramp up. Of course, he says, multiple times. I've left 2 messages and also talked to some guy at the front desk. And? Nobody's turned it in yet. So you did leave it there. I don't know, Meredith, he says, then blurts out an irrelevant fact. I took her there so you could pack in peace. So this is my fault. I didn't say that. I turn away from him and say, Harper, honey, come here, baby.
I want Rabby!
She wails, rubbing both fists into her eyes, her face coated with a mixture of snot and tears. I know, sweetie, I say. Daddy and I are doing our best to find him. She repeats that she wants Rabby, then adds that she misses Rabby very, very much. I know, baby, I say, my stomach in knots, as I glance at my watch. What time's your flight? Nolan asks for at least the 3rd time today. 7, I say. But obviously I'm not going now. Why not? Nolan says. I ask him if he's serious, and he replies, yes, he is serious. Your being here won't change anything, he adds. I bite my lip, nod, and say, that's really nice, Nolan. Thank you. I mean in terms of the damn rabbit, he says under his breath. The phone rings before I can reply, and I make the mistake of glancing at caller ID and seeing Josie's name. Deciding it really can't get any worse, I answer the phone. Hi, Josie, we're kind of in the middle of a crisis here, I say before she can speak. What's wrong? She asks. We can't find Rabby. Oh, she says, clearly thinking that we've simply misplaced Rabby, as opposed to leaving him at freaking Legoland. I walk out of Harper's earshot, cupping the receiver as I fill Josie in. On top of that, I add, I have a flight that leaves in a few hours. Where are you going? She asks. To New York. For work? No. For what, then? I hesitate, wondering why I don't have this answer more prepared than say, I just need to get away for a few days. A few days? So you'll miss Halloween? Yes, but Harper's butterfly costume is ready to go, and besides, Nolan's always the one who takes her trick-or-treating. I just hand out candy. It's no big deal, I say, trying to convince myself of this fact. Huh. Okay. So are you going with Ellen? No, I say. I'm going alone. But I don't know if I can go at all now. Why? Because of Rabbi? She says. Correct, I say, glaring at Nolan. Because of Rabbi. Do you want me to come over? Why? I blurt out, instantly regretting it. Never mind, she says. I'm sorry, I say. When I say why, I just meant, are you coming to look for Rabbi? Because I don't think we're going to find him. I just meant to come be with Harper so you can go, while I distract her. I hesitate, not because I don't desperately want to take her up on the offer, but because it's difficult to admit that we need her, that I need her. My concern for Harper trumps this, though, and I say, that would be great, actually. Okay, she says briskly. I'm almost home. I just need to let Rivas out. I can be there in 45 minutes. Does that work? Yes. Thank you, I say. I'll let Nolan know. All right, she says. Then after a long pause, she makes an even greater offer. I can stay over tonight, too, if Nolan wants. I can be her Rabbi substitute. I almost say that there is no substitute for Rabbi, but Aunt Josie might be the lone exception to that. Could you really do that? I say, swallowing the rest of my pride. That would be amazing. Thank you, Josie. My flight lands at LaGuardia just after 10 p.m. I power on my phone as soon as we hit the runway, checking my texts, praying for good news on the Rabbi front. Nothing, I discover. No word at all from Atlanta, other than a text from Ellen wishing me a good trip and telling me to call her if I have any questions about her apartment. I thank her, then send Josie and Nolan a joint text asking about Rabbi. Still MIA? How's Harper? 30 minutes later, after I've retrieved my suitcase and joined a blessedly short cab line just outside of baggage claim, I have yet to receive a response from either of them. I assume the worst, but tell myself that there is nothing I can do. So I put my phone in my tote bag, close my eyes, and inhale the glorious scent of Queens, a mix of exhaust and garbage and falafels. Suddenly, I'm overcome with exhaustion, and all I want to do is sleep. I remind myself that I can do just that. I can sleep all day tomorrow. I can sleep for the next week. For the first time since Harper's birth, I have absolutely no responsibilities, at least not in an hour-to-hour sense. Yet as I get into my cab and give my driver Ellen's address on East 10th Street, I realize it's not as simple as sleep or freedom. And as the billboards and buildings whiz by me, I feel about as lost as poor Rabbi, wherever he may be.
Chapter 23, Josie. Meredith calls my cell the following morning while I'm still curled up with Harper in her twin bed.
Did you find Rabbi? She demands before even saying hello.
No, I whisper, rolling over toward the wall and keeping my voice low, though Harper could sleep through an air raid. Not yet.
Shit, Meredith sighs. How's she doing?
She's fine, still asleep. I'm here with her now.
In her bed?
Yes.
Did she kick you all night?
I laugh and say it wasn't too bad.
Where's Nolan?
I don't know. I haven't gotten up yet. There is a long pause before she says,
I texted you both last night. Did you not get the message?
Harper and I went to bed early, I say. Nolan went out.
Oh,
she says, sounding surprised.
Where'd he go?
I don't know. I didn't ask. I hesitate, then ask as gently as I can. Is everything okay with you and Nolan?
Yes, she says. We're fine.
Her terse retort, combined with Nolan's rare moodiness last night, only adds to my suspicion that some sort of trouble is brewing. But I know how private and guarded Meredith is about her marriage, and that it's pointless to press her on something she doesn't want to talk about. So I change the subject. I bet Rabby will show up today, but just in case, I did go ahead and order another one.
Another Rabby? She asks.
I tell her yes, that I recalled the jelly cat tag, and after a quick Google image search, located the same beige bunny on Nordstrom's website. I'm having it overnighted, I say.
But she'll totally know the difference, Meredith says.
Remember how Mom tried to replace Bongo? I smile, thinking of the completely random name I gave our blue and yellow betta fish.
Yeah, that didn't fly. It sure didn't, she says, and Harper's savvier than we were.
I know, I say, but I figured it was worth a try. I was thinking I could let Revis play with it for a few days, roll it in the mud, throw it in the dryer on a high setting.
She'd still know, Meredith says with a sigh.
Yeah, I guess you're right, I say, wishing she'd at least give me a little credit for the idea and effort, for the fact that I'm here in bed with her daughter. So what are you up to today?
I'm not sure yet, she says. What about you?
I tell her I'm not sure either, but that I plan to spend it with Harper. If that's okay with you.
Of course it's okay, she says, her voice softening a little. Thank you.
You're welcome, I say. And Mayor?
Yeah?
I hesitate, searching for the right words. Please let me know if you want to talk about anything.
Thank you, she says again. I really appreciate that, Josie.
Later that day, after Harper has broken down over Rabby about 3 times, fortunately never on the phone with Meredith, Nolan walks in the family room where I'm folding laundry and asks how I'd feel about visiting Daniel.
You mean at the cemetery?
It's a stupid question. Where else would we visit Daniel? But Nolan is gentle with his response.
Yes, I was going to take Harper. I'd love for you to come, too. Will you, please?
I look at him, so surprised by the directness of his request that I find myself reluctantly nodding.
Okay, I say, my heart filling with dread.
A few hours later, despite my multiple attempts to divert us, Nolan, Harper, and I slow to a stop along the circular drive of Arlington Memorial Park. Our 3 car doors open, then close in rapid succession, echoing in the serenity of the scenic cemetery. My stomach clenches as I steel myself against an onslaught of memories from December 26, 2001, the last time I was here. They come anyway, of course. The biting cold, the sensation of my heels sinking into the wet earth, the gaping red clay hole in the ground, that solitary bluebird in the barren oak tree overlooking my brother's coffin. We walk in silent single file toward Daniel's grave, Nolan leading the way, Harper between us. She is holding a bouquet of flowers. I have a lousy sense of direction, but I could find this spot without any assistance. That old oak giving me my bearings. Sure enough, I spot my brother's name, his headstone in the partial shade of the tree. A few leaves have fallen on his plot, and I watch Nolan brush them aside. Meanwhile, I stand awkwardly to one side, clueless about cemetery etiquette, but feeling certain that you're not supposed to stand directly over a grave. The sun has been in and out all day, but the sky is overcast now, a slight chill in the air. I shiver, then zip my fleece up the whole way, hugging my arms across my chest, before I force myself to look down at my brother's headstone. The flat gray granite marker bears his full name, the dates of his birth, and his accident. Below that is the engraving of a cross and the words my mother came up with sitting in the kitchen with my dad and our pastor. Beloved son, brother, friend. I remember thinking that the epitaph was too simple, that it left a lot of things out. Grandson, nephew, cousin, boyfriend, to name a few. I very nearly pointed this out in a burst of what felt like post-traumatic stress Tourette's, but managed to restrain myself. Instead, I went up to my room, where I pretty much remained until the funeral, out of everyone's way. Nolan clears his throat now and says in a low, soothing voice,
Harper, honey, do you want to put the flowers down?
He points to the base of the headstone, looking over the top solemn, like a child actress in a funeral scene. She nods and kneels slowly, lowering the bouquet to the ground. A mix of carnations and roses, the public's flowers look cheap, borderline garish. The green cellophane wrapper and flimsy rubber band not helping matters. If Meredith were with us, it would be different. The flowers would have been purchased at a fancy florist, and Harper would be wearing a dress, not a stained t-shirt. The biggest difference, though, is that I would not be here. The burden of her expectations too great for me to bear.
Good job, sweetie,
Nolan whispers, kneeling down beside her, then carefully angling the blossoms toward the stone.
Do you want to pray?
Clearly accustomed to the drill, Harper presses her palms together, scrunches her eyes closed, and says,
God bless Uncle Daniel.
God bless Uncle Daniel,
Nolan echoes. Although I often think of my brother's unborn children, I've never really considered the loss from my niece's perspective. I put it on my long mental list of things to feel sad about later. But for now, I do my best to stay as numb as possible. Meanwhile, Nolan says the Lord's Prayer, which I find oddly formal, or at least old-fashioned. I know I should say it along with him, but do not. I don't even close my eyes, which remarkably Harper does for the entire prayer, right down to his Amen. Then she says it too, a long, drawn-out Amen. Afterward, they both stand and Harper wanders off, a carefree child again. Nolan's arm wraps me in a quick but tight sideways embrace.
Are you okay?
Realizing that I've been holding my breath, I exhale and tell him, yes, I'm fine.
When's the last time you've been back here?
He asks, as I wonder if he knows the answer. A breeze blows my hair into my eyes. I corral the strands behind my ear before confessing. I haven't, I say.
Not ever?
No, not since the day he was buried, I say, feeling ashamed.
Oh,
he says, his lips remaining parted. You think that's awful, don't you? Finally closing his mouth, he shakes his head.
No,
he says, though I'm not sure I believe him.
I just don't think he's here, in the ground,
I stammer. It's the excuse I always give when I'm justifying the decision not to visit my brother, whether to myself or to my mother and sister. Reliably kind, Nolan nods and says he understands. I squint up at the sky and say, I like to think of him up there. He follows my gaze and nods again.
I know what you mean, but I still feel him more strongly when we come here. They say a portion of the soul is always present at the gravesite.
I nod, listening to the sound of silence, then realizing that it's not silent at all. Leaves rustle in the breeze. A dog barks in the distance. A car engine turns over. Meanwhile, I feel Nolan looking at me, and know that he expects a reply. To each his own, I finally say, worrying that I might sound flippant. Meredith would definitely hear it that way. But Nolan isn't Meredith, fortunately, and only murmurs his agreement.
Yes, everyone is different about these things, but you definitely do believe he's somewhere, right?
His brow furrowed, he looks directly into my eyes. I hesitate, thinking that sometimes I do, but sometimes I do not. I don't know, I finally say.
He looks at me aghast. But Josie, you have to, he says. Otherwise.
Otherwise what? I retort.
Otherwise, how do you make sense of it?
I don't make sense of it, I say under my breath, thinking that more than anything, I hate that notion of God's plan. Before I can say more, his phone rings, saving me. He pulls it out of his front pocket, glancing at the screen. I think we both expect it to be Meredith, at least I do. But he holds it up, showing me an unprogrammed 404 number. Mumbling that he has no idea who it is, he answers it anyway.
Hello,
he says, his voice as anxious as I feel. I hear a woman's high voice droning and assume it's a telemarketer until Nolan begins to grin. Watching him smile is like watching the sun come out. I remember my mother once saying, before Daniel died, back when she used to make such poetic observations. It was, and still is, true.
That's awesome. Thank you, he says excitedly. We'll be right there. Thank you so much.
He hangs up, slides his phone back into his pocket, and looks up with tears in his eyes.
Harper, sweetheart, guess what?
What?
She yells back, shielding her eyes with her hand.
They found Rabbi. He's safe and sound at Legoland.
Nolan shouts to both of us. As Harper cheers and sprints toward us, Nolan beams, giving me an I-told-you-so look.
See?
He says. See what? I reply, though I know what he's thinking because I've heard him say it many times before. Something about Daniel being Harper's guardian angel. Something about him looking out for all of us. As if God's plan would ever, in a billion years, include taking a young man but saving a stuffed rabbit. Later that night, after I've rather easily put Harper to bed, with Rabbi's assistance, I come downstairs to find Nolan eating the remains of Harper's macaroni and cheese directly from the pot with a big wooden spoon. He gives me a sheepish smile, wiping his mouth with his hand. I smile back at him and say, "Don't worry, I do it too. Why is food always better when you eat it right off the stove?"
"I don't know, but it really is,"
he says, taking one last bite.
"Are you hungry? We could throw in a pizza or order something."
"No, not really," I say. "I was actually going to take off."
"Right now?" he says, looking disappointed. "Do you have plans?"
"No," I say, though Pete did send me a text about an hour ago asking what I was up to. "But now that we have Rabbi back, I figured you didn't need me."
"I don't need you.
But why not stay and hang out for a bit?" he says. I remember Meredith once told me that Nolan can't stand to be alone.
"One beer?"
"Sure," I say. "Why not?" Nolan smiles, heading straight to the refrigerator. He opens it, grabs two Budweisers from the door, and hands me one before sitting at the kitchen island. I stand across from him, leaning on the edge of the counter, twisting the top off.
"So, how's life?"
he asks, taking the first sip. "It's fine," I say with a shrug. I fleetingly consider telling him about the latest development with Gabe and his offer, but decide against it, knowing he has enough on his mind.
"How's your life?" I ask him. "Oh, it's totally swell."
He gives me two thumbs up to reinforce the sarcasm, and I take it as an invitation to ask him point blank what's going on with Meredith.
"Who knows?"
he says with a long sigh. I take a sip of beer, choosing my words carefully. "Why is she in New York, exactly?"
"She's just taking a little break,"
he replies, his voice trailing off. "Is anything wrong with y'all?" I press, knowing that the situation must be fairly dire if Meredith is missing Halloween, right up there with Christmas when you have a 4-year-old. Nolan looks up and to the left, which, according to body language experts, is strong evidence of an impending lie.
"No," he says. "Nothing's wrong."
"Okay, but just so you know," I say, "liars always look up in that direction." Nolan gives me a half-hearted smile, then says,
"Well, I guess it takes one to know one."
"Seriously," I gently press, "what's going on with you and Mare?"
"I don't know, Josie," he says, shaking his head. "She's just not happy."
"So what else is new?" I say. "Mare's been in a bad mood since she came out of the womb."
"I know," he says, "but it's worse than usual."
I ask him why, feeling annoyed that my sister can't just snap out of it and be happy, especially given all that she has to be happy about.
"Do you think she's depressed, like, clinically?" No, I don't think that's it. She definitely had depression after Harper was born.
His voice trails off as I remember Mare's postpartum baby blues. They were mild, but still concerning, especially to my mother.
But this is different, he continues. This is almost like a midlife crisis.
I stare at him, thinking that it is such a loaded term, almost always referring to infidelity of some kind. I tell him my sister would never cheat.
Oh, I know, he says, staring at the label on his beer. I don't mean that kind of midlife crisis.
I just mean, maybe she'd rather be alone than married to me.
She wants a divorce?
I say, floored.
Yeah, I think she might, he says, meeting my gaze.
No way, that can't be it, I say, shaking my head. Nolan gives me a look that can only be classified as sad.
Deeply sad. I think it is, Josie. She pretty much told me that it was.
But you're the perfect husband, I blurt out, feeling a wave of animosity toward my sister. How dare she do this to him? He gives me a small smile, but still looks mournful.
Yeah, well, thanks. But I think we both know it doesn't work like that. Looking back, I don't think she ever loved me.
Of course she did. Does, I say as I'm bombarded with a distant memory of my sister and me sitting in the dressing room of the bridal shop where Meredith purchased her gown. I remember how she talked about having cold feet, being unsure about Nolan. It seemed ridiculous at the time. It still seems ridiculous. She could never do better than Nolan. Nobody could.
What? Nolan asks. What are you thinking?
I glance away and say, nothing.
You just looked up and to the left, he says. Now you're lying.
I swallow, almost telling him about that moment in the dressing room, then quickly deciding it isn't my place. Besides, what good would it do at this point? Instead, I take a deep breath and say, I just think Meredith is hardwired to be dissatisfied, and she always second-guesses herself. Think about her chosen profession. What was that all about, anyway? She always wanted to be an actress, so why did she go to law school?
Exactly, he says. But Josie, that's my point. I'm the relationship equivalent of law school. She regrets law school. She regrets me. She regrets her whole life.
That's not what I meant, I say, realizing that I've just made him feel worse. I just meant, Meredith is complicated. She's always been that way. And she got way worse after Daniel died. He gives me a surprised look.
What? That can't be a revolutionary concept, can it?
I ask, thinking that we all got worse after Daniel died. Meredith was just a little darker to begin with.
No, it's not that, he says. I just think this might be the first time you've ever brought up Daniel with me. It's always me bringing him up with you.
I nod, my stomach clenching like it did in the cemetery. I know, I say.
Why is that? He asks. Why don't you ever want to talk about him?
I swallow, sweat beginning to pool under my arms. I don't know. It's like we said at the cemetery today. Everyone is different about this stuff, about death and dealing with it.
Yes, but it's always struck me as odd. I've always thought you would be more like Meredith, and she'd be more like you, you know?
I shake my head, not following. Why's that? Maybe, I say with a little shrug. Then hoping to change the subject, I ask how we got from his marriage to me.
I think it's all related, he says without missing a beat.
I force a laugh and try to sidetrack him.
What? How do I have anything to do with your marriage? You don't, he says, my decoy not working. I'm talking about your family. What Daniel's death did to your family. To all of us.
I know what he's getting at, and I desperately don't want him to go there. He does anyway, staring into my eyes in a way that I can't escape.
"Can we please talk about that night, Josie?"
he asks. My throat feels too tight to reply, so I just shake my head.
"It's been almost 15 years, and we've never talked about it. Doesn't that seem strange to you?"
"Not really," I manage to say, averting my eyes. "I mean, what's the point?" My voice cracks, then trails off.
"Josie," he says, "I think we both know the point, and I think it needs to happen. Now."
My heart starts to pound in my ears as I try one last time to make it all go away, just as I've been doing since the night I first suspected the truth, the night Will found me in bed with Gabe. "Do we have to?" I whimper.
"Yes," he says, "we do.
I mean, Josie, shit, we were together the night Daniel died,
and yet we've never talked about.
We weren't together." I cut him off, bracing myself, praying that maybe, just maybe, I'm actually wrong about my hunch. "We were just at the same bar. Lots of people were there."
"I know. Lots of people who had absolutely nothing to do with Daniel,"
he says, holding his bottle cap between his finger and the counter. He flicks it hard, and we both watch it spin, then stop, before making eye contact again.
"Josie," he says, the color draining from his face, "I have to tell you something."
"No," I say, my heart pounding in my chest, my instinct to flee kicking into high gear. I take a few steps backward, actually looking around the room for my best exit. But Nolan darts around the counter, putting his hands on my shoulders, holding me in place.
"I have to," he says again more forcefully.
"I know what you're going to say," I say, my vision blurring.
"I don't think you do," he says, still holding on to me.
"Yes, I do," I say, shaking free, fighting back panic tears. "He wasn't getting a burger that night, was he?" Nolan stares at me a beat, then shakes his head slowly.
"No," he says, "he wasn't."
"He was coming to get me, wasn't he?" The tortured look on Nolan's face confirms my worst fear, even before he nods and says yes. "Fuck," I say, trembling. "I knew it. I knew it was my fault. Fuck."
"No, Josie," Nolan says, "it wasn't your fault."
"Of course it was my fault," I say, choking back a sob. "He was coming to get me."
"But don't you see, Josie?"
He stares at me. "See what?"
"Don't you see that I was the one who called him? I was the one who told him to get in his car and come get you. So see, it was my fault, not yours."
"But if I hadn't been drunk."
"But I wasn't drunk, Josie. Don't you get that? I wasn't drunk at all. All I had to do was drive you home. I was talking to some girl. Some stupid girl I wanted to sleep with. I didn't want my fun interrupted, so I called Daniel to come get you, and then I left the bar. I didn't even wait for him to get there. I didn't know he never got there. Not until the next morning when Meredith told me."
His face crumples, and he begins to break down and cry in a way that I have never seen a grown man cry. Not even my father. When Daniel died. My flight instinct grows stronger, and this time I manage to break free to the family room. I sink into the sofa, burying my face in my hands. Nolan's footsteps are behind me. I can see him in my peripheral vision and feel his weight on the cushion next to me, his arm enveloping me.
"Josie," he says, there's so much pain in his voice.
"Please look at me, Josie." I do, for his sake. "I'm sorry," he says, tears streaming down his face. "I'm so fucking sorry, Josie." "I'm sorry, too," I say, refusing to let him shift the blame from me. "He always told me not to drink so much. He always warned me about being like Dad.
Yes, but he told me, just the day before, that I should stop chasing stupid girls and try to find someone I really cared about, like Sophie.
Well, neither one of us listened to him, did we? I say.
But if only I had taken you home myself.
It was my fault. We continue like that for some time, making disjointed, parallel confessions.
I was having sex with some girl when he died. I was wasted when he died. I didn't know until the next morning. You knew before I did.
At some point, when there is nothing left to say, he reaches for my hand. I give it to him. It should be awkward, sitting there holding my sister's husband's hand. But it's not. It's actually the opposite. He feels like my brother. Not Daniel, but another brother. We sit in silence for a long time before I finally ask the question burning a hole in my heart.
Does Meredith know?
I look at him, holding my breath, waiting for the answer, thinking that a yes would explain so much of her animosity toward me. Yet, I can't imagine her holding this back for so many years, not when she throws far smaller things in my face. Sure enough, Nolan says,
"No, she doesn't know any of this. Nobody knows. Everyone thinks he was going to get a burger."
His voice shakes, but he continues.
"The next day, when your parents asked me to call Daniel's friends, I took his phone. I knew his passcode, 4265.
"Why was that his passcode?" I ask. It is beside the point, but I still want to know.
"It spells Hank, for Hank Aaron."
"Oh," I say, thinking of the baseball card that he used to keep in his wallet. How my parents had tucked it into the breast pocket of his jacket right before they closed the coffin. I swallow, willing myself not to throw up.
"So anyway, I knew his passcode," Nolan continues, "and I got on his phone and checked his call log. I prayed that he'd called someone else after we talked. Maybe Sophie before she got on her flight. But no."
He shakes his head, then takes a deep breath, trying to keep it together.
"The last two calls were with me."
"Two calls?" I say.
"Yes," he says. "The first was 52 seconds, when I asked him to come get you."
"And then you called back?" I ask softly.
"No, then he called me about 15 minutes later to tell me he was leaving the house, on his way."
"Do you remember that call?"
"Of course I do," he says. "It was the last time I ever heard his voice. It was the last time anyone ever heard his voice."
"How long did you talk that time?" I ask, sure that he knows the answer.
14 seconds. 14 fucking seconds. You know why it was only 14 seconds?
"Because he was driving?" I ask, thinking of how responsible Daniel always was about driving. About everything.
"No," he shakes his head, "because I was in a hurry to go. That girl I was talking to was on her way outside, and I didn't want her to leave without me."
"Was she gone?" I ask.
"Almost," he says, "but I caught her on the way out the door. I went back to her apartment, and I had sex with her. And now?"
I squeeze his hand, giving him the strength to continue.
"Now, I can't even remember her goddamn name."
Chapter 24. Meredith. On Sunday morning, I awaken to the sound of distant church chimes and a sharp chill in Ellen's simple whitewashed bedroom. Shivering, I pull the goose-down comforter up to my chin, rolling over to face the window. The curtains are drawn, but sheer enough for me to make out the silhouette of a ginkgo tree, its twisted bare branches bending toward the window panes. I wonder what time it is, but can't tell by the flat northern light. It could be as early as 7, as late as 9. I decide it doesn't matter, a realization that is more disorienting than liberating. So I reach for my phone, shocked to see that it is a few minutes past 10, about the latest I have slept since Harper was born, at least when neither of us was ill. The mere thought of her sets off a fresh quake of homesickness. No matter how surly she is in the morning, I am always happy to see her face first thing, her cheeks flushed, her hair a tangled mop. I close my eyes and can almost smell the odd maple syrupy scent of her skin after a long sleep. Suddenly, desperate to hear her voice, I call Nolan. He doesn't answer, just as he didn't answer last night or yesterday afternoon. My only update coming from Josie, when she texted me a photo of Harper embracing Rabbi, along with the caption, "Reunited and it feels so good." My heart flooded with relief as I texted her back immediately, virtually begging for the details, adding extra exclamation points and question marks. But 3 hours passed before she wrote back a glib reply. "Found at Legoland. All's well that ends well. Enjoy your vacation." I call Nolan again, listening to the futile sound of ringing, followed by his chipper outgoing message. This time, I leave a message. I calmly ask him to please call me back as soon as he can, doing my best to keep agitation out of my voice. I know I have little standing to be angry, yet I am anyway. Yes, I am the one on a boondoggle in Manhattan, but it all unfolded at his prodding, his virtual insistence. And now he is punishing me, cutting me off, making a point. This is what your life will be like without me, without us. I tell myself to get up, seize the day, and embrace my soul-searching sabbatical. So after a quick shower, I change into my city uniform, jeans with a black sweater, a black leather jacket, and black boots. I put on oversized sunglasses, throw my hair into a utilitarian ponytail, and sail down 4 flights, out the heavy front door of the brownstone, into the crisp fall day. It is windier than I expected, more unpleasant than invigorating, but I tell myself I will warm up. I just need to keep moving. For the next 5 hours, I aimlessly wander around the city on foot and by subway, from the village up to Chelsea and the far reaches of the Upper West Side, then across the park, down Fifth Avenue, and the whole way into Soho. Along the way, I duck into coffee shops and browse boutiques, stopping whenever and wherever my fancy strikes. I sit on random benches, people watching. I speak only when necessary, to order a sandwich, ask a clerk a question, thank the man who slid down to make room for me on the subway. Otherwise, my inner monologue and urban solitude are uninterrupted, my life examined from every angle. I think a lot about the past, particularly the years I lived here, feeling as disconnected from those memories and friends as I do from my college years and acting. I have no desire to get in touch with anyone I used to know, even to meet up for a drink. And I can't help but wonder what this says about me. I like to think of myself as merely introverted. But is it something stronger? Am I a pathological loner? An outright loser? If so, no wonder my marriage feels empty, like something's always missing. No wonder I can't get along with my sister. Maybe our turbulence is more my fault than hers. I think of how happy she looked the other night at her birthday dinner. How fun always follows her. How fiercely loyal her friends are to her, especially Gabe. I tell myself that I have Ellen. But deep down I know it's not the same. Perhaps because Ellen has Andy. And that he is her best friend. The person to whom she is the most loyal. By dusk, I am freezing, and my heels are beginning to blister, and all I want to do is go home and take a bath. But I stop at Duane Reade on the outskirts of Chinatown, buy a diet Snapple and a box of Band-Aids, then head back outside to hail a cab. "Where to?" the driver asks, as I slide into the taxi, which reeks of artificial evergreen. "I don't know yet," I tell him. "Could you just drive, please?" He nods, indifferent as long as his meter is ticking. While I study the bridge of his nose, forehead, and eyes in the rearview mirror, trying to determine his ethnicity based on his features and last name, Abrama. He could be Mexican, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, Israeli. The possibilities are as endless as my potential destinations. Where are you from? I finally ask, caving to the curiosity. He raises his chin, answering proudly. I'm Calabrese, he says, in a way people from home tell you they're a third or fourth generation Atlantan. Oh, beautiful, I say, though I've never been to that part of Italy. That's the toe of the boot, right? I ask him, reminding myself of my sister and how she always chats with strangers. Mr. Abrama nods again, unimpressed by my command of world geography. A few minutes pass before he asks, Did you decide? Decide what? I say, thinking of Nolan. Where you want to go? I clear my throat, then say, Yes. Could you please take me to Times Square? 20 minutes later, I pay my fare, and am deposited one block away from the pulsing neon heart of the city. I head directly for the TKTS booth under the red steps, suddenly craving a live performance. I'm in the mood for low-key and talky, not slinky or razzle-dazzle, but it's nearly 7 o'clock, so I take what I can get, ending up with a ticket to Chicago, a show I've seen twice before and don't particularly love. Still, as I make my way to the Ambassador Theater and settle into my balcony seat, waiting for the curtains to part, I feel something come alive inside me. By intermission, I feel like a new person, or maybe just my old self. I check my phone in the theater lobby and see that I finally have a missed call from Nolan. I press myself into a reasonably quiet corner and call him back. Ha, he says, his voice barely audible. Where are you? At a show, I say. With who? I'm alone. Oh, are you having fun? I wouldn't call it fun, but it's nice. How are you? How is Harper? We're fine, he says. We got Rabbi back. I heard, I say. Josie told me. Oh, right, he says. Can I talk to Harper? I ask, though the second warning to return to our seats has just been issued. She's asleep, he says. She has school tomorrow. I'm taking off for her Halloween parade. Oh, that's great. So what else is going on? I say as the lobby empties. Well, Josie and I went to the cemetery yesterday. With Harper. We took flowers. Josie went? I ask, more than a little shocked. Yeah. Wow, I take it that was your idea. Yeah, he says. It was, but she went. And we had a really good talk. About Daniel? Yes, he says. I shake my head, thinking of how many times I've tried to get my sister to go to the cemetery or have a substantive conversation about our brother, never to any avail. Resentment builds inside me, toward both my husband and my sister. Well, thanks for the call. I need to go. Intermission's over, I say, thinking of how he annoyingly always calls it halftime. No problem, Nolan quickly says. Enjoy the show.
Chapter 25, Josie. For several days following my conversation with Nolan, I tried to delude myself, a skill I've honed over the years. I keep telling myself that my actions were just one piece of a giant, tragic puzzle, and that 100 little things had to happen for Daniel to die. 1,000! If you back up far enough, tens of thousands. Take, for example, Scott Donahue, the driver of the Denali that hit Daniel. I have never laid eyes on the man, but somehow I know his part of the story. I know that on the night of the accident, He was headed to Walgreens to buy cough medicine for his 3-year-old son. So right there alone, I can see that Mr. Donahue and his wife had to meet, marry, and conceive that particular child who would then get sick that